From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in a neighborhood where lots of the men beat their wives and kids. So Lorenzo and his mother weren't alone. When Lorenzo was 14, he found out the family secret. His father was a murderer. He killed his first wife. On today's Fresh Air, Lorenzo Carcaterra talks about his new memoir. Also today, a detective writer who used to be a detective. We talk with Parnell Hall. Like his main character, Hall became a private eye after failing at writing and acting. Of course, Hall is no longer a failed writer. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews a new punk rock anthology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate leaders are trying to reach a compromise on the standoff over President Clinton's $16 billion jobs bill. Today, the Democrats failed for the third time to end a Republican filibuster that has stalled the bill for more than a week. Republicans say they won't yield until the measure is trimmed down and arrangements have been made to pay for it by cutting other programs. President Clinton accused the Republicans of political posturing at a time when the nation needs new jobs. The Senate is now in the third day of what was supposed to be a two-week Easter recess. Today, Secretary of State Warren Christopher issued another, more pointed warning to the Bosnian Serbs. If they do not sign a peace agreement, he said, the U.S. might try to end the U.N. arms embargo against Bosnia quite soon. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Asked how soon, Christopher said on NBC's Today show, it would not be a matter of months by any means. Lifting the arms embargo would level the playing field, Christopher said, adding, it does seem unfair the way the embargo is operating at the present time. The embargo hurts the Muslim-led government of Bosnia more than the Bosnian Serbs, who are able to get weapons from neighboring Serbia. But key U.S. allies, some of them with veto power in the Security Council, oppose lifting the U.N. arms embargo, saying that would only intensify the fighting and force an end to humanitarian efforts. Christopher acknowledged today those are both likely outcomes. Responding to Christopher's comment about a level playing field, British officials say lifting the embargo would produce a level killing field. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The government of Russia has accused Ukrainian leaders of reneging on earlier pledges to make Ukraine a non-nuclear state. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
In its most sharply worded statement in the ongoing struggle over the nuclear arsenal of the former Soviet state, the government of Russia said today that Ukraine is claiming ownership of the nuclear weapons on its territory and is now striving to become a nuclear power. Ukraine does not intend to eliminate all its nuclear weapons, Russia's deputy defense minister said, adding, this is unacceptable to Russia. Ukrainian leaders have repeatedly stated they do intend to dismantle all their nuclear weapons, some 670 strategic warheads. But negotiations between Moscow and Kiev on removing the weapons have made no progress, and the Ukrainian parliament has yet to ratify the START 1 and nuclear non-proliferation treaties. Ukraine's failure to ratify START 1 could throw into doubt the entire arms reduction process that Moscow and Washington have negotiated over the past 2 years. Ukraine says it wants security guarantees and financial support for disarmament before it signs the treaties. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 3,379. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR. 16 Haitian refugees were admitted to the United States today for treatment of their AIDS virus infections. The 16 adults were accompanied by 4 children who are not infected. The Haitians were part of a group of more than 200 who've been held at the U.S. Navy base in Cuba because they were in a sort of legal limbo. They've been found eligible to apply for asylum but couldn't enter the United States because of their HIV status. Last week, the Justice Department announced it would allow 36 HIV-positive Haitians into the country. A federal court had ruled that the refugees weren't getting adequate medical care at the U.S. naval base. The Space Shuttle Discovery is poised for an early morning liftoff from Cape Canaveral. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Workers Workers at the Kennedy Space Center have begun loading 500,000 gallons of fuel aboard Discovery's large external tank. Everything appears ready, and forecasters predict no problems with the weather at launch time. Liftoff is set for 1:32 a.m. Eastern Time. The early hour launch allows the shuttle to position itself in the proper orbit to study Earth's ozone layer. During the 8-day mission, the 5-member crew will gather measurements over the northern hemisphere, looking for holes in the ozone that may allow deadly ultraviolet rays to seep through at dangerous levels. Central Floridians will see a brief moment of daylight as the shuttle begins to leave the pad. Shuttle watchers along the eastern seaboard should also be able to see the orbiter as it travels north along the coast. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
South African President F.W. de Klerk and ANC leader Nelson Mandela held an unscheduled meeting today after a new round of violence that has killed 23 people since Friday. The two leaders issued a joint statement saying their discussion centered around violence and progress toward power-sharing talks. State-run television said that 10 ANC members were killed today in an early morning attack. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest was 14 years old when he found out that his father was a murderer. He killed his first wife. That revelation is at the center of Lorenzo Carcaterra's new memoir, A Safe Place. Lorenzo is managing editor of the TV series Top Cops and a former reporter for the New York Daily News. He grew up in a tough Manhattan neighborhood known as Hell's Kitchen. His father was a violent man with a raging temper. He frequently beat Lorenzo and his mother. It wasn't until a 1969 trip to Italy that Lorenzo's mother finally told him the family secret. He and his mother were visiting her family. They were far away from Lorenzo's father, who was home in New York. After Lorenzo's mother told him the story of the murder, she left him alone with his thoughts. I asked him if he was shocked.
He was no different, my father, than any of the other men I knew from the neighborhood we lived in. Beatings both to children and to wives were what they did. You know, it was how they solved, how they dealt with imminent problems. And so he didn't seem all that unusual. You know, and then you look back, you were told that, A, he's a murderer, so then you piece back things in the past and you start to see that all it would take for him to get to that point is just to push the envelope a little bit further, to keep the fuse lit a few minutes longer. And so then things started to make, to become clearer in my head about him.
Well, when you came home, when you got back to New York with your mother, and he beat your mother again.
All right.
Did it go through your mind, well, maybe this time he's going to kill her?
Well, I thought that to the day he died or to the day he could no longer function while he was in a hospital. But I'm always amazed to this day that he never did. And it wasn't a question that, you know, he loved wife number two more than he loved wife number one. In fact, I think he loved his first wife more than he loved my mom. But there was something that held him back. And it could be anything. It could be having killed someone once, he knew how far he had gone and held back. But something held him back. But it's one of the major surprises of my life that he actually never did kill her.
Why did he kill his first wife? I mean, it wasn't like he beat her and beat her and he didn't realize how much he was hurting her and beat her to death. He intentionally smothered her by putting a pillow over her face in a hotel room.
Yeah, it was called a crime of passion. It was they had separated. They had been married 6 years. And in that period, it was a very stormy 6 years. They were very passionate when they were together. And then they had these outbursts where they would separate for months or weeks at a time. This was, I believe, the third such separation. And they've been negotiating. It was almost like a negotiation to get back together. And it seemed like they were on the right path towards another reconciliation. So he left that morning for the hotel where his wife was staying at with the full intent that this would be the final discussion and then they would be back together again as a family. In the hotel room, she apparently told him that the reconciliation was not possible because she was in love with another man. And this set him off. I mean, he was A, violent man, B, he was an incredibly jealous man. And he just went into a rage in that room and put a pillow over her face and killed her.
Did you tell your father that you knew?
Not at 14. I didn't tell my father for 8 years after that. For a number of years, it was an unspoken understanding, it seemed to me, between the two of us. I think he knew I knew. I thought he knew that I knew. You know, so it was all that kind of situation. But we never openly spoke about it, and because I simply felt that I needed to know more about the situation than just the one sentence that my mother had told me. When I got back from Italy that summer, I went to the high school library, and I pulled on microfiche, the New York Times, and I found a clipping from November 1, 1946 that, in a couple of paragraphs, talked about my father's arrest. And so that sort of started me. I would talk to a lot of people, both friends and family, but given the nature of the situation where people had for years not talked about this, you couldn't directly ask them. So you had to sort of work around corners and ask indirect questions that would someday, over periods of years and periods of answers, get you to where you wanted to get to. So that took a long time.
And when you did finally tell your father, what did you say? What did he say?
Well, it wasn't like I woke up that morning and said, oh, today, you know, I'm going to talk to Dad about it. But he was having a fight with my mother. I was 22, and just to cool him down, we went and I dragged him to my car for a ride, and we were on the Long Island Expressway. He said one thing, I said another thing, and I just sort of blurted it out about his wife. And he slapped me and asked me never to speak about it again, and we did not speak about it again after that time until he was in the last months of his life in the hospital, in St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in Manhattan, where we spent a lot of time and a lot of hours talking about it.
What kinds of things did you say to each other?
Those last 5 months, he was always curious as to why I wanted to know. I really didn't have a detailed explanation as to why I wanted to know. I just felt it was important to me. It was a part of his life, and since he was my father, it was a part of my life. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about, he very much in those 5 months, very, very carefully and slowly, because he was very ill, took me from day one of that marriage practically to the final day of that marriage. And that was what I needed. That's what I really wanted from him all those years. And he was more than open about it.
When you found out that your father murdered his first wife, did you feel more responsible about protecting your mother against your father's beatings?
Yes, I think so. I think that's one of the reasons I stayed at home till practically my mid-20s, when most guys were getting their own apartment at 18. Yeah, I was always concerned about it. I mean, he was very physical towards her. I mean, he thought nothing. To him, it wasn't even an argument just to simply slap her. That was sort of, you know, if she asked the question, that was inappropriate. So I was very concerned, and she's not a big woman. She's a very, like most Italian mothers, she's about 5'1", and a very quiet woman. So I stayed around longer probably than I should have for my own benefit, but I stayed around for what I thought were valid reasons.
There's a passage from the book I'm going to ask you to read in which you describe how you finally left home. And your father had brutally beaten your mother. Then he was beating you. You took out a knife and what you were considering using it?
Briefly, yes, yes. It was a pretty intense scene. And
do you want to set it up, set up the scene before you do the reading?
Yeah, it was just one final, one final confrontation in a series of violent confrontations. I mean, I just felt that in order for, and these were feelings that I had throughout, but it just came to a boiling point that one of us had to either die or leave, and that it just couldn't go on anymore.
Your father had a knife. He dropped it.
Right.
Okay, and that, why don't you read the passage for us?
Okay. "Come on, One Punch," my father said. "Stand up for yourself. Be like your old man. I killed. So can you." I took a step toward him, the knife at my side, wiping at thin streams of blood with the back of one hand. Outside, I heard loud knocking on our front door. "That's it," my father said. "Get even. That's what you want. Here's your chance. Won't take much. One shove, fast, in and out. You can do it. I know you can." We stared at each other for the longest time, both of us breathing hard, our bodies covered in sweat. Our hands were clenched. One of mine was still wrapped around a knife. "What's it gonna be, One Punch?" my father said. "I ain't got all day." I tossed the knife back to the floor. "You're not worth it," I said. "I know," my father said. He put a hand towel under the cold water faucet, wadded it up and tossed it to me. "Clean yourself up," he said. "You got blood all over your face." He lifted my mother to her feet and helped her onto a chair. He then bent down, picked up the knife, and held it in his hand for a few seconds. He turned around and threw it into the kitchen sink. "I can't stay here anymore," I said to both my parents. "I just can't." "Then don't," my father said. "Don't worry about us. We'll be fine." I bent down and kissed my mother on the cheek and walked by my father, nodding at him as I passed. "Hey, One Punch," my father said. "You were right about one thing." "What?" I said, turning back to him, one arm inside the sleeve of a denim jacket. "You'll never be a murderer," my father said. "Never. It ain't in you. Now you can rest easy. You're not going to be like your father. To hell what everybody else may tell you. You and me, we know the truth." I nodded and walked out of the apartment and far away from the only life I had ever known.
Were you worried about that? Were you worried that you had the potential of being a murderer yourself?
Yes. I thought about it for well, I think the thing that I know, because of the upbringing I had and the family I have and had, that I'm capable of it, that my father did it, and I'm capable of it. I do know we're all capable of it. The only thing is I'm comfortable with the knowledge that we can do it. We are capable of killing someone, each of us. And for a number of years, that it was a fear inside of me rather than just a fact. It was more fear than fact. I was afraid to have children for a number of years. I was afraid to get too involved with someone who may want to marry. But now it's just a realization that it's a fact which exists, that any one of us at any given time can take someone's life. My father just happened to have been one of those people who did do that. And I'm well aware of the violence that's inherent in all of us.
When you had your hands on a knife during that fight with your father, did you ever seriously consider stabbing him?
Oh, yeah. And it wasn't a long thought. It was for a few seconds. But, yeah, I could have seen myself do that, sure.
And what stopped you?
Well, my mother was there, for one thing. And two, you know, maybe I'm not as tough as I thought, or maybe I'm not as violent as I imagined.
Your father was really egging you on. I mean, he'd beaten your mother.
Yeah.
He'd beaten you. He was saying, come on, just do it.
Yeah.
But,
I think he wanted to see if, you know, what I had in me, whether I was capable of doing it to him at that moment.
You think in some sick way he would have been proud of you if you stabbed him?
No. I think he was proud of me that I didn't.
Uh-huh.
Because that, you know, I think in his own way he probably thought about it too, that whether I was capable or whether I was going to kill somebody. And this proved to him. I mean, he rested easy after that.
Uh-huh.
And also, the times we saw each other after that were not violent ones.
My guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra. He's written a new memoir called A Safe Place, The True Story of a Father, a Son, a Murder. And it's a story of his father, how his father beat his mother, and how his father murdered his first wife. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra. He's written a new memoir called A Safe Place, which is the story about his father and how Lorenzo learned that his father actually killed his first wife. When you walked out on your parents and you just, after that fight, you decided to just leave home,
mm-hmm.
What did you think would happen when you left? I don't mean just that night, but...
In general?
Yeah. Leaving them to each other the way you did.
I thought what would happen is what did happen, and luckily that they would eventually move back to Italy. They were living then in the Bronx, in an area that was sort of starting to fall apart, and my mother had apartments in Italy, and they could have a better life. They did move back there, and while the con games my father pulled continued, they were of a much more limited scope, and while the beatings continued, because she was there surrounded by her own family, they were very limited in number. So I thought she'd be safer there. And And in order for me, for her to get there, I had to leave. And it dawned on me, you know, probably a couple years later than it should have, that that's what would have happened. And that's what in turn did happen.
You'd advised your mother when you were in your 20s that she should just get away from your father,
yeah.
that she should go to Italy herself,
right.
go back to her family and get away from him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that made a lot of sense to you. Why wouldn't she do that?
Well, she's of a generation. She's cut from a different cloth. I mean, they're just women like my mother play the card that's dealt. And the card that's dealt is if you're happily married, you're married to a terrific man, that's the card. If you're married to somebody who beats you and abuses you and doesn't work and rifles up debts, that's the card. But whatever, regardless of what color the card is, you stay. You don't leave.
Do you think your parents loved each other?
Yeah, I do. I do. There were times when I thought I was the one that was insane. I mean, they'd have a fight at 5:30, 6 o'clock that seemed like Ali Frazier, where things were breaking and things. And then at 8 o'clock or whenever it was, 8:30, they'd be in the living room hugging and kissing, laughing and watching Perry Como. So I'd sit in the kitchen and say, you know, it's got to be me. It's got to be. I got to be the one that's nuts because look at them, you know. And anybody who walked in from the outside and saw them, as people have. I mean, people told me who've read the book said, you know, I'm really surprised. I always saw them together and they were always laughing and giggling like newlyweds. There was a genuine, they grew to love each other. I don't think when they married they loved each other very much. But I think they grew to love one another and care about one another. I mean, I would watch my mother care for him in his last weeks as if they had, you know, an Ozzie and Harriet relationship throughout the 35 years. I mean, you would not know. The nurses at the hospital always commented to me about how close they were. And I think they were very close. It's just the nature of my father's personality was a violent one, that he solved the slightest problem with a fist. But my mother, I think, understood that about him towards the end.
Did you grow up thinking this was normal, that, you know, you get married, you beat your wife, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, for a lot of years. I mean, I didn't know any woman up until I went to Italy. I didn't know any woman who had not at least who had not been beaten at least once or twice by her husband in any given year. Our next door neighbor was always in some sort of bandage. The woman who lived next door to us, and her husband was in a wheelchair and he beat her. So I mean, I never met any housewife, and that's all they were. None of them were working women. They were all housewives, who did not get beaten. So I began to think this was you met somebody from the neighborhood, you married, and 6 months later you beat her up. But luckily I found out otherwise.
Your father wanted you to be tough.
Yeah.
His nickname for you was One Punch.
Right.
Did you want to be tough too?
I think all the kids at Hell's Kitchen thought they were tough, so we all thought we were tough. But whether I was or not, I don't know. I didn't enjoy being tough. I mean, the playing the street swagger that you had to play in those neighborhoods. I was much happier sneaking into the library next door and reading some Jack London. But you had to play the game of tough. I wasn't very comfortable with it, never was, and in truth wasn't very good at it.
You know a story that I find just particularly interesting in the book. It's a story of how you took your lover, who I guess she was about to become your fiance, to meet your father, and your father did this great performance.
Yeah.
He was saying to her, my son told me you were attractive. He didn't say you were beautiful, and he went on and talked about like what a
terrific lady she was.
Yeah, well, how great marriage was, and how much he loved your mother. And
well, I tell you, my father could be here on this show today.
Yeah,
and I'd let him speak for a lot of time. And at the end of the show, you, as well as some of your listeners, would say, "This guy is fantastic. What a great guy. I wish I had a father just like him." And he knew how to charm people. He was a great storyteller. He was a kind of terrific at parties. And people always, you know, I'd have a fight with him on a Saturday night. And then Sunday, people would call and say, "Oh, I met your father at a party, man. What a great guy." And you'd just want to eat the phone. but, yeah, he had that knack. He was really good with women, especially, and just smooth talked. My mother-in-law met him briefly, And I mean, he hit on her. So it was.
You're kidding.
No. So it was. You know, he heard she was a widow. She's a doctor's widow, and she was very attractive. And you know, he was telling her how beautiful she looked. How he had never met a woman from Ohio.
Have you gotten offers to make this story into a movie?
They're talking about it now. I don't know anything specific yet, but you know, they're talking about it.
It's funny, you know. You describe how when your father was in the hospital, he thought. This would be a good way to make a lot of dough, you know, if he told you his story that somebody would want
to
buy the book or make the movie.
Yeah. This for him, this is the ultimate con. And that's I mean, this is like getting money to tell people everything you did in your life. I think, in a way, I'm sorry that he's, in many ways, I'm sorry he's not alive. But one of the main reasons, he'd be on the book tour. I mean, save me some travel time. He definitely would be... having a great time.
That's too weird to think about.
Yeah, but I tell you, he'd be a great guest.
But, you know, I'll be honest with you, and I've said this before, you never know when you're interviewing someone who is the person that goes home and beats their wife afterwards.
Right.
I mean, I truly have had someone tell me after interviewing like a really sensitive poet, I've had somebody say, I know this person. I'm at the school where they teach, and they seduce their students or they beat their wife, and you just never know.
Well, these guys that I grew up, the guys like my father, they wouldn't do that. I mean, sexual abuse was non-existent in Hell's Kitchen. If they found out you did that, they'd fry you. I mean, there was one drug dealer growing up as a kid in Hell's Kitchen, and somebody put him on the roof of a building and put 3 bullets in his chest and killed his dog. So that was alien. Physical violence was not the same, did not translate into other forms of violence. They were very much of-the-moment men. If... that moment, they were hot-tempered, and that moment you had ticked them off. The only reaction they knew was to hit you, to come at you. And that's it. They saw nothing wrong with that. And the men that exist like that today still see nothing wrong with that. They're very comfortable, and they're very gentlemanly. I mean, they would pull a chair out for a woman. If you didn't hold a door up for a woman, I would get slapped. They had their own sort of bizarre manners.
One last question. You've
sure.
gotten out of that world, you know what I mean, and that mentality. What about friends who you grew up with?
Well, you know, my grammar school class at Sacred Heart, I believe that as of last count, I finished grammar school with 32 boys. 20 are either dead or in prison. So
there
wasn't very much. We weren't on the fast track to the Ivy League. The ones that made it have done okay. The ones that, you know, I mean, if you can come out of there, you know, the rest of life, I mean, it's hard, but it's not as hard as what you've seen. And you can handle yourself. If you can get through that kind of a life, and a lot of us did, one is an assistant district attorney. Another is a social worker in the Bronx helping kids. So once you can get through that situation, I think you might not have a lot of great qualities, but there's something to you. There's something to you because you've survived something that very few people have survived.
Lorenzo, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Lorenzo Carcaterra is the author of the new memoir, A Safe Place. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Parnell Hall's first love was acting. When that didn't work out, he became a screenwriter. And when that didn't work out, he became a detective. Now he's a successful writer of detective novels about an inept private eye who's also a failed actor and writer. Coming up, we talk with Parnell Hall about the many failures that preceded his success, like his part in Arnold Schwarzenegger's first movie, Hercules in New York. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews DIY, a new collection of punk rock from the 70s and 80s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Senate leaders are searching for a compromise after Democrats failed for a third time to end debate on President Clinton's economic stimulus package. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
It was the third time in 4 days, but the result was the same, 49 to 29, with the Democrats coming up 11 votes short of the 60 they need for cloture. Republicans say the president's $16.3 billion stimulus plan includes too much pork barrel spending and will increase the deficit. But Democrats charge their opponents with trying to undermine the president's overall economic program. Here's Michigan Democrat Don Riegel.
There are people that want to be president in 1996. They want to hurt this president now. They want to hurt this president now by denying him his economic program. And it's the country that's suffering.
Senate leaders met today to work out a compromise. Republicans say they will support funding for unemployment benefits, but want to cut other spending in the package. All the White House will say is that it's willing to listen to the terms of a compromise. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
A spokesman for the UN High Commission on Human Rights says that Serbian commanders have made clear their position, that the Muslim enclave of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia must be given up, or the Serbian army will soon take it by force. Alan Little of the BBC reports.
Aid workers here now privately believe that the fall of Srebrenica is inevitable. The priority is to rescue the civilians from what would otherwise be their fate at the hands of the Bosnian Serb army. The question of how this is to be achieved without the mass panic and overcrowding of trucks that caused the deaths of at least six people last week has still not been resolved. The UN have only 8 military personnel in the town and are unable to mount effective crowd control. The Bosnian government have given their approval for the evacuation. It may be that they too now consider Srebrenica a lost cause. It is only 3 weeks since General Morion made Srebrenica a cause celebre, promising never to abandon it. He had intended to take in a company of more than 100 men and an international field hospital. The Serbs wouldn't let him.
Alan Little reporting from Sarajevo. According to Washington officials, the U.S. may call on allies to lift an arms embargo on Bosnia if Serbian factions continue to turn down a U.N.-sponsored peace plan. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, appearing on NBC, said it's something that the U.S. would think about doing soon and not in a matter of months. He said that Washington would go to its allies and see if there is a consensus for lifting the arms ban. Christopher said at present the Bosnian Serbs have all the heavy weapons and he would like to level the playing field. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,379.19 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Officials of the European Community have agreed to work on lower import fees on Russian goods as a way to help that nation's economy. Last week, a group of creditor nations agreed to reschedule payment on $15 billion in Russian foreign debts. Tokyo said it is putting together an economic aid package, indicating that Japan has dropped its demand that Moscow first return four islands taken at the end of World War II. Japanese officials say they plan to have their aid package ready by next week's meeting of the financial and foreign ministers of the group of seven industrial nations. Passover begins tonight for millions of Jews around the world, but the week-long religious observance also has a special meaning for the federal agents stationed in Waco, Texas. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Attorneys for cult leader David Koresh and a top lieutenant have assured that the Davidians plan to surrender at the end of Passover. But at a press conference in Waco this morning, FBI agent Richard Swenson sounded deeply skeptical that the Davidian leader would keep his word, having broken two earlier promises to give up.
David's a con artist, and that's what he does. That's what he does frequently. But David sees things as he wants to see them. He uses things as he wants to use them.
One of the frustrating aspects of dealing with the cult, agents say, is Koresh's often singular interpretation of the Bible. The sect has reportedly commemorated Passover for as few as 3 days or as many as 7 days. As the last month has proven, they simply don't know what Koresh will do next. In Waco, I'm John Burnett.
General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has wound up a 2-day visit to Somalia and says he's hopeful that in the not-too-distant future, security operations can be turned over to the UN. That change in command is now slated for early next month, but Powell said an exact timetable has not been set as yet. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of detective writers have never hired a detective, let alone been one, but writer Parnell Hall used to be a detective. That's not the only thing he has in common with his main character. They're both failed writers and actors. Well, not exactly. Parnell Hall isn't a failed writer anymore. His 8th Stanley Hastings mystery, Actor, has just been published. Hall also writes courtroom dramas under the name J.P. Haley. Detective work sounds pretty intriguing, but to Hall it was just a job, something to tide him over in between acting and writing. His work as a private eye wasn't anything like what he'd read about in fiction. He told me what his work was like.
You know the lawyers who advertise on TV? You know, you have an accident, fall down, dial us, we will come to your home, no fee, unless we get a settlement?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I worked for a detective agency that serviced them. And so what we were handling were negligence cases. People would trip on a crack in the sidewalk, fall down, call the lawyers. No self-respecting lawyer was going to go running around to their houses as they were advertising. They would hire detectives to do so. And I would come in a suit and tie and investigate these things, sign them to retainers, and go out and take a picture of the crack in the sidewalk that tripped them. And that was basically the job, and that's 90% of the private detective actual business that is done.
So what are some of the things besides cracks and sidewalks that you had to take pictures of for documentation?
That was mostly it.
Really?
Yeah. Occasionally there would be a subway, it would be an automobile accident. If I had to investigate a murder, and I sometimes did, I wouldn't care about who did it. What I would care about would be the broken lock on the front door that allowed this person to get in. So it would be a question of not who was guilty, but who could you sue?
Right. So would you call your work part of a pretty sleazy operation?
It was kind of, this is the McDonald's of the legal profession, you know? And when I wrote my first book, and I started writing my first book as soon as I began this job, what I really based it on was something from my acting work. Years earlier, I was in a movie, and I was playing a cop, and we were finding a body down by the riverfront. Of course, we didn't get changed there. They were doing wardrobe out of a brownstone in Chelsea. And I went there, and I put on my policeman's uniform. And now I'm waiting on the sidewalk out front for the Teamster to arrive and drive me to the set. So I'm standing there. A man comes running up to me. He says, "You got to help me. My girlfriend's been kidnapped." You know, and my mind is blown because I'm about to play a scene in a movie. And, you know, I'm thinking about that. And I said the worst thing I could possibly have said to him. I said, "I'm not a cop." And the guy just looked at me like, "How can you be standing there in a uniform telling me this?" And he cursed at me and ran off down the street. And that was the basis for my first novel that I wrote 2 years later. I had a similar situation of a man comes into the private detective's office and tells his big story about how he got involved with drug runners and he ripped off some of the cocaine and now they're after him and they're trying to kill him and you've got to help me. And this is the typical scene where the private detective would strap on his gun and say, there, citizen, I'll handle this. And my man, who is a private detective doing the type of jobs I did, taking pictures of cracks in the sidewalk, says, "I can't help you. I don't have a gun. I have a camera." And he sends the man away, and the man is subsequently killed, and he spends the rest of the book trying to atone for the fact that he wasn't as good as a fictional detective.
Now, you made your own detective, Stanley Hastings, a not very good detective. I mean, there's a great scene in your new novel where he does this whole Perry Mason thing in which he gives the motive and the killer, and of course it's all wrong. He gets it right later, but the first time around he doesn't get it right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So why did you make him a less than really showy, fantastic detective?
What I tried to do was make him real, and that's basically the difference between what I'm writing and most fictional private detectives is that my detective is a real person, and he has the problems that a real person would confront in any given situation. For instance, in one of the books, he's often dealing with locked doors, and his problem is, he says, you know, a TV detective would be able to pick this lock, and failing that, he'd kick the door down. I have none of these talents. If a door is locked, I can't get in.
What kind of writing had you failed at before you became a detective?
What I'd failed at largely was screenwriting. I'd been relatively successful. I mean, I'd sold several screenplays and actually made a living at it for a while. And then I had the misfortune of getting one of them produced, which is probably the worst experience a writer can ever go through in his life. And it was less than a year after my first one was produced that I was working as a private detective.
The one that was produced, was that Chud?
That was Chud, yes, which is rather embarrassing. Saturday Night Live satirizes it occasionally. But my script for Chud in 1980 went to AFCO Embassy, which nobody in Hollywood reads these things. They have somebody read them and they get coverage, you know, a single page that says what the plot is and what the prospects are. My coverage on Chud, the original script, said, "This is the best written horror movie I have ever read for AFCO Embassy. The characters are three-dimensional, witty and likable. We really care what happens to them. I see a lot of money in this." They turned it down. That's their right, but what would it have had to say to get them to take it? And then when the movie finally did get produced, the actors walked on the set and said any damn thing they felt like it, and the plot and the wit and everything went right out the window. But that's Hollywood. That's what I love about writing the books, is what I write is what you read.
Now, Chud, I should say, stands for Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers.
That was not my idea.
It was not?
That was handed to me by a producer, and I was told to write it.
So what was your idea?
The whole movie was not my idea. I'd done three movies for this producer, and, you know, naively, I came to him and said, "Which one are you going to do first?" He said, "Well, I'm going to do a horror movie called Chud." I said, "Why would you do that? The ones I've done for you, one was a script Cary Grant had once owned as a star vehicle for himself. Another was an Ira Levin novel. Why would you do something about cannibals living in the sewers of New York?" He said, "That's because that's the one I can get the money for." And it wasn't mine. It was somebody else's script. And he came back to me and he said, "I have one problem. I can get the money for this, but I don't dare show the script to anybody. Can you rewrite it for me?" And I read it and I said, "No." And he came back to me 2 months later, and he said, "Write anything. Call it Chud. Make it stand for cannibalistic. The money is there." You know, and I did it for him as a favor, and I've been living it down ever since.
Writer Parnell Hall is my guest. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Parnell Hall. He writes the Stanley Hastings mystery novels. In your new novel, Actor, the failed actor-turned-detective gets a phone call at mm-hmm. the beginning telling him that...
Telling him that an actor has just dropped dead 2 days before the opening of Arms and the Man, and his old college chum wants him to step into the role that he did 20 years ago because he presumably knows the lines. Of course, he's forgotten them all, and who wouldn't after 20 years? But that's how he gets dragged into it.
Did you used to dream of such a call?
I used to have the actor's nightmare. I dreamed of the call, yes, that would happen. It never happened to me. What did happen to me is that when I was an actor, I got called in to do a role on 4 hours' notice, and it was in our town. And it was a part of Mr. Webb, which I had not even seen in rehearsal. And he starts off by doing a two-page monologue to the audience. He comes out, he's alone on stage, and he just talks to the audience. And I sat there and I memorized that. And I've often had the actor's nightmare of being on stage in a play that I've never rehearsed in which I don't know the lines. And this was that nightmare come true. But I went out and I did it, and it went well, and it got laughs, and I got through it. And by the end of the play, in Act Three, which we never got to rehearse, my daughter in the play is leading me around by putting pressure in the back of my neck and poking me in different directions, and I'm ducking my head off stage and peeking at the script and saying lines. And I got through it, and I've never had the nightmare again.
Now, while we're on the subject of your illustrious acting career, you were in a movie that your character was in as well. It's an Arnold Schwarzenegger film called Hercules in New York, a film I must admit I have never heard of.
You know what? No one has ever heard of it. Everybody thinks his first movie was Pumping Iron, but he made this back in 1969, and I had never seen it up until a couple of weeks ago, actually. But it came out on video cassette, and I ordered a copy, and just the week before it arrived at the video store, it was on CBS Late Night, and I taped it, so now I have it on tape twice. And it's one of the most embarrassing things in the world. I wear a leopard skin suit, and I'm standing outside a movie theater with a chariot buying a hot dog from a soubrette vendor. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, a very young Arnold Schwarzenegger, comes running out of the theater, and while I'm buying the hot dog, he steals my chariot and drives it off down Broadway. I see this and I scream, "Come back with my chariot," and I chase him down Broadway. The soubrettes vendor yells, "You forgot your sauerkraut," and chases me down Broadway. This ends, believe it or not, in the middle of Central Park. I finally lose the chariot and everything, and the hot dog vendor puts the sauerkraut on the hot dog, end of scene. It's on my resume.
That's why I knew about it.
Well, also, I used it as the basis for my book, Juror. I gave that all of that exposition to Stanley Hastings, and it's the reason that he gets called for jury duty. And it was the reason that I got called for jury duty also. You know, you're exempt from jury duty if you're the sole proprietor of your business, and you can prove it by your tax record. Well, I was, except because that played on late-night TV, a $40 residual attached to my tax record came through on a W-2. And if you have one W-2, you're not self-employed and you have to serve. And that happened to me.
So this movie, Hercules in New York, it was supposed to be a comedy?
It was supposed to be a comedy, yeah. It was. Some of it would have been high camp if they left it alone. But the producers knew that that his voice would just not do, so they dubbed it.
They dubbed Schwarzenegger's voice.
They dubbed Schwarzenegger, yeah, because otherwise, you have struck Hercules. It was great. It was just, you know, wonderful, but they couldn't let it alone. Also, they knew the name Schwarzenegger would never go, so they changed his name to Arnold Strong, largely so that, they had the co-star Arnold Stang, the guy who used to do the Chunky commercials, and that way they could have Arnold Strong and Arnold Stang in Hercules in New York.
Would you like to get together with Schwarzenegger and reminisce about old times?
I'm sure he'd be delighted.
Yeah. So was his part bigger than yours? Was he Hercules?
He was. Oh, no, this was his first vehicle. This was his vehicle. He was Hercules. He was, you know, they got him in there and ripped his shirt off in every scene they possibly could and had him, you know, doing feats of whatever.
Well, I like this. Well, your big movie credit in acting was Hercules in New York, and in screenwriting it was Chud.
Yeah. Yes, it's a distinguished career, is it? No wonder I'm a writer.
Parnell Hall's new novel is called Actor. This is Fresh Air. The Republican filibuster continues in the Senate. Linda Wertheimer, any exciting sound bites for All Things Considered?
Of continuing debate?
Yeah.
Well, this is a fine old-fashioned way of getting what you want by causing the whole system to grind to a halt, and the Republicans so far have managed to stymie all efforts to get President Clinton's stimulus package out of the United States Senate. So we'll pay a little bit of attention to that. We're also going to take a look at the future of Silicon Valley and the future of women in the Navy. Apparently, the Secretary of the Navy has decided to open a few things up. And the future of the Italian government, which at this moment is bleak.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rhino Records has a new 9-volume anthology exploring the punk rock revolution of the late 70s and early 80s. It also reflects the parallel revolution in pop music, music in the classic format of the 3-minute single, which had all but vanished in the world of progressive rock and disco. The anthology is called DIY, for the music that was known as Do It Yourself. The anthology includes recordings that were never played on American radio. Rock historian Ed Ward has a review.
Is she really going out with him?
Is she really going out with him? Strange words to usher in a rock and roll revolution. But it was the Damned with New Rose who broke open the floodgates of punk rock in Britain in 1976, notwithstanding Malcolm McLaren's best efforts with the Sex Pistols. New Rose is just one of the 173 songs to be found on Rhino Records' new 9-volume anthology, DIY, covering the pop and punk music that came in the wake of the Damned and the Sex Pistols in Britain, and Patti Smith, Television, and the Ramones in New York. The set is cause for some celebration, because it's comprehensive enough to examine this incredible time in some detail, but it's also cause to examine one of the most arrogant instances of cultural censorship ever to occur up to that point.
Well, the kids are all hopped up and ready to go. They're ready to go now. The guys that surfed them, they're going to the disco.
New York had punk first, thanks to the Ramones, and New York gave it its name, thanks to writer Billy Altman, who'd coined the term punk rock to refer to older music not unlike that which the Ramones and their peers made. But Britain needed punk more. Life under Margaret Thatcher was hard, and with a music scene dominated by sludge like Queen and good performers gone soft like Rod Stewart, the blast of fresh air was welcome.
One, two, three, four!
Nobody ever expected a song like the Adverts' One Chord Wonders to climb the charts, and it didn't. On the other hand, Britain's small enough that it's possible to track sales in record stores fairly easily, and before long, some of this stuff started leaking onto the charts, if not onto the BBC. The small record companies like Stiff and Chiswick that had started by recording punk also had an ear for pop, for somewhat more accessible and traditional stuff, in other words. Like this record, made by the Adverts' producer.
In a bid to save a bit of power, he got 50,000 watts. He
in a big acoustic tower. Security's so tight tonight. Oh, they're ready for a tussle. Gotta keep your backstage passes. Cause your promoter has the muscle.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
Nick Lowe's vision was a little weird, true, but his pop sense was right there in the groove. And in America, a generation was listening to this stuff, too. The gospel, according to the Ramones and Sex Pistols, had spread across the nation. You can do this, too. If you were an arty geek, well, so were the Talking Heads. If you were politically radical, so were the Clash. Gay? Here's Tom Robinson. You're a girl? Role models aplenty. Nor was it just the punk stuff that was being responded to, although it was getting the headlines. There was brilliant pop music being made in this country at this time, too.
There you go.
I never heard the Liars' I Want to Help You, Ann, or any of dozens more of its quirky cousins unless you were either very lucky or you sought them out. Nor did you ever hear any of the second generation of British pop bands, like the Tourists. As you can hear, So Good to Be Back Home Again is one of those perfect radio records. But what happened? What happened was that the generation of music business types who had come up as fans during the 60s closed ranks at record companies, at mainstream music media like Rolling Stone, and especially at radio stations. The new music was declared a passing fad, an aberration. Some of the more extreme punk records were trotted out as typifying the whole lot. Even the obnoxiously derivative power pop records of L.A. skinny tie bands, like 2020 or The No, a genre Rhino's series covers in a bit too much depth, were lumped in with bands like Fear and the long-gone and lied-about Sex Pistols. By the time MTV came along to partially save the day, the DIY, do-it-yourself ethos had given way to a more cynical and technologically dependent one. Another age of innocence passed into the mists of time.
Ed Ward lives and works in Austin, Texas. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Trying to forget your generation.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, covering the war in the former Yugoslavia, we talk with NPR's foreign affairs correspondent Tom Gelton. He also reported on the Gulf War and conflicts in Latin America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.